This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
In the Jodcast studio with me today is Tony Rushton, who is a research fellow at Oxford Astrophysics. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
So you're not new to Jodrell Bank, are you? Why don't you give us a bit of an overview of your career history so far?
No, not at all. I originally did my undergraduate and postgraduate degrees here at the University of Manchester. I was originally based out at the Jodrell Bank Observatory before moving on to other institutes. Once I'd completed my degrees here at the University of Manchester, I then had the opportunity to go work for the European Southern Observatory in Sweden for a few years before returning back to the UK at the University of Southampton, and now I work at the University of Oxford.
Right, excellent. So your research is in X-ray binaries. Mm. What's an X-ray binary?
Well, fundamentally, it's a binary star system that produces an awful lot of X-rays. In fact, they're so X-ray bright that they tend to dominate the X-ray sky. If your eyes could see in the X-rays and you look up in the sky, rather than just seeing your typical isolated stars, you would mostly see these flaring binary systems. Reason why they produce extremely bright X-rays is because there's typically a what we call a very compact object in the binary system. So something like a neutron star or a black hole that has extremely strong gravitational well. Next to the compact object, there is typically another main sequence star which is accreting onto the compact object, and that is causing gas to be accelerated to extremely high temperatures, which is emitting all the X-ray emission.
So how do you know what each of those objects is in the X-ray binary? Is there a range of different types of companion star that are donating the material onto the compact object, or is it just one type of star? Or
it's a little complicated. There's a whole variety of different processes that go on. It's not necessarily just a normal main sequence star like our Sun, which is accreting onto the black hole or the neutron star. Sometimes we have a massive high mass star, which is at least 10 times bigger than a standard sun-like star. And then you have a whole range of different parameters in the system, depending on what's going on, what's the transfer rate of the gas onto the black hole, and mm-hmm. various other conditions, like the magnetic field. And there's a whole zoo of different physical processes that go on around black holes. And although we are just really scratching the surface of what goes on with these objects, we do know there's a whole range of different processes that we observe in mm-hmm. we look at these objects.
And they give rise to different observational phenomena that you can then disentangle.
Absolutely. Again, it's a little complex because we have to look at these objects across the entire electromagnetic spectrum, and we see complex variability happening all the way from gamma rays, X-rays, optical, infrared, down to the radio emission. And all the different wave bands vary with time and with different class of objects.
So how do you know the compact object is either a neutron star or a black hole, or is that still something of a grey area?
That's a good question. A lot of people ask me, how do you know it's a black hole is there if it's black and you can't see it? Of course, what we actually do is we infer the presence of a very compact object like a black hole based on the way the compact object interacts with the surrounding environment. So a black hole will cause a slightly different accretion disk to form around it than what a neutron star would form. At least that's what theory tells us. And the classical signature from the X-ray band is we look at the different X-ray colours of X-ray binaries, and we trace out how the luminosity and the colour, or spectra, if you like, of the black hole behaves, and we can clearly see distinct classes of objects which we attribute to being a different mass of compact objects.
So right.
A neutron star or a black hole.
So is that a very clear cut-off between the two?
Yes, they clearly trace quite different different shapes mm-hmm. In the in the spectra and how the luminosity evolves. And then what we do is we look at those observational parameters, and we see these different classes of objects, and then we take other independent information, like the optical information, which will tell us about the binary orbits of the system, so give us what the period is of the system, which will also help us infer the mass of the of binary system. And we can clearly see a correlation where the objects which have appear to have a high mass compact object in the optical clearly behave in a certain way in the X-ray colour.
When you have one of these objects in your field of view, is the majority of the emission coming from the accretion disk and the compact object, or is it from the companion?
That's a good question. There's actually a third possibility. The majority of the emission could be coming from a jet that's being accelerated away from these objects. So I should explain first that when we look at these objects, which we believe are gas coming from a star accreting or falling towards a black hole or a neutron star, forming an accretion disk, which emits a lot of electromagnetic radiation, because of the very, very strong magnetic fields that are entrailed in the accretion disk, a fraction of that gas is accelerated away from the black hole along the poles of the accretion disk, or perpendicular to the accretion disk, into highly collimated jets of plasma. The particles accelerated up to very close to the speed of light. And these produce very intense radio waves from a mechanism called synchrotron radiation. And it's not entirely clear to us if all of the emission that we see in the X-rays is coming directly from the accretion disk, or is actually coming from partly coming from the jets. So to answer your question, it depends which part of the spectrum that we're looking at, what's dominating most of the emission. Roughly, we think that in the radio band, all the emission comes from the jets, possibly up to the far infrared. And then, certainly if we have a high-mass star, for example, which are very luminous, we believe that the optical emission comes from stellar companion. And then as we go into the X-rays, we see a thermal component, which we think comes from the inner parts of the accretion disk, followed by a second X-ray spectral component, which we believe either comes from electrons that are scattered off the accretion disk or comes directly from the jet emission. And these questions are still quite open as to what is exactly the physical accelerating processes around these objects.
Yeah, I was going to ask what could possibly cause a magnetic field to appear in an accretion disk. I've always pictured accretion disks as quite chaotic regions of the sky, whereas something is obviously making these jets incredibly narrow and collimated.
Well, the exact composition of the jets isn't quite clear. It must be charged particles like electrons, which are probably the majority of the composition of the jets. And in terms of the order of the accretion disk, well, although there's a lot of viscous forces that go on inside the disks, generally most of the particles are rotating round in one plane of accretion. So they're going with the rotation of the compact object or in a retrograde motion of the object. And this ensemble of charged particles, I believe, can create a strong magnetic field, will produce intense radio emission.
So are there other sources in the sky that produce jets, and do they all look the same?
Jets are seen on a huge range of different scales and sizes in the universe. So we see jets of plasma just coming from our own sun, for example. You see the charged particles being ripped off. So they're on a relatively small scale. You see jets coming out from what we call young star objects in our local galaxy, so when stars are formed, gas accretes into accretion disk and forms a new star, you see acceleration of jets. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about X-ray binaries, that obviously they produce strong radio jets, but we also see jets happening on much larger scales in the form of what we call active galactic nuclei. So we believe now that most galaxies have at their galactic centre a supermassive black hole. So a black hole that has a mass of well over a million to maybe tens of billions of solar masses, possibly a billion stars all compacted into one location. And these objects produce huge jets that are sometimes larger than the host galaxy, and certainly much larger than the Milky Way galaxy. So we can have jets that are relatively small from black holes in X-ray binaries that have the size of, say, 100 astronomical units, up to jets that have something more like 100 kiloparsecs, so the entire size of a galaxy. Yeah. And it's amazing that you can see such the same physical processes of accelerating particles towards a black hole and then accelerating away from them, but over such a range of sizes. Something we don't really see elsewhere in the universe.
Yeah, I've seen some really beautiful pictures of Cygnus A with just, it's just a diffuse blob if you look in the optical, but switch to the radio and you've just got a tiny thing in the centre with these huge lobes coming out. Yeah. And it's I had that as my desktop background for quite some time, actually.
And it's beautiful because you can really see where the jets are accelerated from the centre of the galaxy all the way through the galaxy, and then they just hit what looks like a brick wall, which is the surrounding interstellar medium, clustral medium for the galaxy. And you just see, as soon as the particle carry on, and then as soon as it leaves the galaxy, the density of the surrounding medium is slightly bit higher, and that causes the particles just to stop and crash. And you see the hot spots of these interaction regions bright up quite nicely in the X-ray band as well.
Mm. Yeah, these are really lovely images, actually. So X-ray binaries, do they tend to be quite stable systems? Are these jets quite stable, or do they vary? Is there flickering? Is there any transient activity that goes on with these systems?
Unfortunately not, or maybe fortunately. they're quite interesting because these objects are really transient. Their changes in their behaviour is incredibly rapid over timescale of sometimes over just a few hours they change up to a few days. So what happens is there's instabilities in the accretion disk as the gas falls towards the black hole. These instabilities cause complete changes across the whole EM spectrum. They will go from what we call a slightly quiescent level, so they're just ticking along quite happily with maybe just being fed a little bit of gas, and suddenly a deluge of particles heads towards it, and you see the X-rays go crazy. Some objects flare many orders of magnitude, 100 times, 1,000 times brighter than what their sort of background normal level is like. And that can happen over a space of just a few days. And then you see everything else happens. The radio can come up at a slightly later time. And you can sometimes see optical flares as well.
So how easy is it to catch the rise of these flares? I mean, if they're quite transient and unpredictable, how can you make sure you've got a telescope in the right place at the right time?
Well, that does the trick. Typically, these things want to go off late on a Friday evening when you're settling down for your dinner. And I aim to try to put systems into place that gets robots and computers to try to catch these sources for us. So we do this quite successfully with our X-ray telescopes in space. We have an X-ray telescope that was put up by NASA called the SWIFT X-ray telescope. And that has an instrument on board which monitors most of the sky for new gamma ray flares. And they have a piece of software which just says when a new gamma ray is detected in the sky, the telescope will automatically reposition itself and the spacecraft will slew to the new part of the sky and look at it with its X-ray telescope. That's a pretty neat little piece of software that we've got these robots in space now that just automatically decide, right, I'm going to go and look at that part of the sky because something cool happened over there in the X-rays and gamma rays. We now try to extend that to looking at, to include our ground-based telescopes. So part of our project that we're involved with in the 4Pi Sky project at the University of Oxford, we have a system in place now that takes messages from the SWIFT computer, which gets relayed down to a ground center in NASA and then relayed over the internet. And we send that relay when we detect an interesting source in the sky. We send it to a telescope that we use in Cambridge, at the University of Cambridge, called the AIMI telescope. And that is a radio telescope that will automatically reposition itself and try to look at that part of the sky that's just flared in the X-rays as quickly as possible.
Right.
And we more or less do that with no human intervention at all. So we really have space robots that are taking over our telescopes.
You must be really popular with people that have already got observing time on these telescopes and suddenly they start slewing to another object.
Well, we hope that their observations can be redone because most of the sky, when you think of doing astronomy, you think of slow-moving nebula that don't, you know, and we talk about all these things will change after a million X years from now. While our objects flare up on the timescale, or change, if you like, on the timescale of, say, a few hours, maybe even minutes. So we do, of course, have to work out how to prioritise which objects to look at. But typically, if we have to override something, we hope that that observation will be able to be rescheduled in the future. So we will all be able to get what we want. There aren't currently that many big radio events happening in the sky.
Mm.
The really big events really only happen once every few years. This is what happened earlier in the year. We had an object that we've known about for the last 25 years or so, and it sat dormant, just being a happy black hole that's taking a little bit of gas from its companion star, and it's producing a little bit of X-ray, a little bit of radio. And it didn't do anything for 25 years. And then a few months ago, all of a sudden, it flared, and it became the brightest X-ray source in the sky by a large amount. There are other sources that produce X-rays. There's an object we call the Crab Pulsar, and the Crab Pulsar is one of the brightest persistent X-ray sources, and so much so that we even use it as a sort of a unit. We talk about an object is in millicrabs, so a fraction of this really bright object called a crab. With this black hole we've been monitoring, called V404 Sig, it went up to 40 crab. So 40 times the usually brightest source on the sky. So we couldn't not see it with all our telescopes. And we had our AMI telescope in Cambridge automatically picked up the detection in the gamma rays and got onto the object. And we saw it increase and become one of the brightest radio sources in the sky a few days later. And we spent a few weeks just frantically running around getting as many telescopes. I think at one point, just about every telescope on the planet was looking at this object. You can see it with amateur optical telescopes, with just a 12-inch telescope, it was that bright. And it's really fascinating when it happens. It's all panic stations, because you've got to try to talk and communicate. And fortunately, with better communication tools, like Facebook and Twitter and email and... we have been able to coordinate our activities across the globe a lot better than we did maybe 25 years ago. And now we have this really rich set of data which we're currently in the process of analysing.
That's fantastic. So the 4Pi Sky project, does it look for gamma ray emission just from X-ray binaries, or is it just checking out anything in the universe that emits gamma rays?
It doesn't look for gamma rays. It follows up alerts that tell us that there are things like gamma rays that goes off. Currently, we get the system to follow up all the gamma ray flares that the NASA SWIFT telescope detects. But we extend the program to try to look for any radio transients. What we're really interested in is finding anything that's transient and produces radio emission. So we also will follow up optical observations like supernova. There are flare stars. There are also AGN and what we call tidal disruption events, where we believe a star is tidally disrupted as it heads towards, or it gets too close to a supermassive black hole and causes a transient event. And the real difficulty is that we don't really monitor the sky in the radio band. It's technically quite possible at the moment to monitor the entire sky for gamma rays because of how the technology works. But for radio telescopes, it's quite limiting, and we can only really look at a small patch of the sky.
Yeah.
So 4Pi Sky's job is to try to take as many different sources of new transient information and automatically slew and get onto that source.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks very much. That's been really interesting, and hopefully we'll hear from you again sometime in the future.
Yeah, thank you. It's been really good coming here again.
Excellent. Thanks.